Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, sitting in for Frank Gaffney, who's taking the war for the free world on the road today. I have the pleasure of being joined this first segment by Diana West, who writes at dianawest.com and is the author of Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Welcome to the show, Diana.
Thanks, Jim. Great to be with you.
Well, I know one thing you focus on a lot, and we greatly appreciate your good work in this area, is how Europe has just become an object lesson in how to take a population with values antithetical to your own, not assimilate, and try to allow their values to dominate your own. So let's talk a little bit about what Europe's done wrong with their Islamist infiltration and almost, at this point, an invasion. Geert Wilders, a great politician in the Netherlands, has talked about this quite a bit, and you wrote a piece about his prescriptions for this. Tell us a little bit about what Geert thinks we should do.
Yes, well, Geert Wilders has been really the leader, the leading politician on this for a decade now, just about a decade, maybe less. It's amazing how he is right now at the top of the polls in the Netherlands. His party has grown from a party of one going back to about 2008 to now being the leading party. And he's been very consistent in his prescription of how to save Europe. It now becomes more urgent as, yes, it is an invasion. I wouldn't even say it's almost an invasion. It is an invasion. It's a demographic overwhelming of the host countries, the indigenous peoples, if you will, of Europe. And his first prescription is to close the borders to any more mass immigration from Islamic countries. And he says if he becomes prime minister in the next elections, which is not impossible, that he would close the Dutch borders at once. What does this mean? This is a way of attempting to restore the Dutch country, the Dutch culture, to its place as the leading culture and not an Islamizing culture. And this is really what the lesson of Europe is. We are seeing an Islamic Europe take shape before our eyes. We just had the terrible death in a stabbing of an aid worker in Sweden, a 22-year-old woman by the name of Alexandra Mazur. She was killed ministering to migrants. And just a week or so ago, and I just find today that when the home for these migrants, the other aid workers wanted to hold a memorial service for her, the town council said no. And this was in deference to Muslim feelings. Now, when you are at this point where you cannot even have a memorial service, you are in an Islamic culture. You have accepted, you have submitted to Sharia norms. This is what Geert Wilders' program is exactly designed to reverse, but it is not being implemented at this point anywhere in Europe.
Now, part of the problem, I guess, is now you've got a European Union, but you've got no European people. You know, you have a collection of countries like the Netherlands, like Sweden, Norway, Germany, France. They're distinct individual cultures that the bureaucrats have tried to form into a European Union and tried to graft these very left-wing, progressive, sweetness and light, milk of human kindness, social democrat values onto. And it hasn't worked. And what certainly hasn't worked was bringing in all these folks who absolutely do not want to be Europeans and allowing them to dominate their host countries, as you mentioned. So is there any chance they can turn the assimilation around? I mean, they've begun deporting. Sweden's deporting tens of thousands. These aren't war refugees in the most part. They're economic migrants, correct?
Yes, that's very correct. Well, another piece of the absolute necessary prescription, and this is one of Geert Wilders' points also, is leaving the European Union, is breaking that monopoly of power in Brussels. It's sweetness and light on the outside, but it's actually I see it as nation murder. I mean, this is the basis of this notion of getting to the European superstate, is destroying the individual nation states and their cultures that make up Europe, that happen to be on the landmass of Europe, that have developed there, and are our own cousins. I mean, this is where we come from as well. It's a very evil plan, and when you say it doesn't work, I totally agree with you, but the bureaucrats in charge, the power mongers, Mrs. Merkel comes to mind, they are absolutely not reversing course. For them, this is working. This is the imposition of the utopian, if you want to call it that, dream of destroying the nations of Europe and replacing them with this world in which the super state controls rogue populations by coming down with speech repression, which we're already seeing. We're seeing in Netherlands, as a matter of fact, a hotline for individuals to call if they see, quote, hate speech on social media to the police. So we're seeing the repression of freedom of speech, and then controls, very invasive controls of the security state to actually try to impose a civil society by force, so that people can ride the metro with 50,000 cameras and probably policemen on every car to prevent the kind of violence that we're also seeing breaking up. What Europe has done is brought Tahrir Square into the heart, into every town square, really. And now the state is trying to impose its will and make it work. They're not trying to reverse it. And this is where you see the rise of the nationalist patriotic parties, the populist parties, so-called, that wish to reassert themselves so that they don't die. So it's actually a very dire situation. The sweetness and light is merely the packaging, but it's actually a very coercive and freedom destroying structure that is being put into place to control this riotousness. It's really a very a kind of civil war that is underway at this point, you know, in a sense of roiling discontent and upset, and you know, you see the street demonstrations of the Pegida party, the anti-Islam party, spreading across Europe. These are peaceful demonstrations by people who do not wish to be replaced, because this is what these governments, these bureaucracies are doing. They are replacing the peoples of Europe, the cultures of Europe, with their vision of multiculturalism, Marxism, utopianism. I mean, this is dangerous stuff, and these are the kinds of people who are in charge, and this is the tug of war we're watching.
We're talking with Diana West about the decline and potential death of Europe, the great European Union project, by its own hand and by the hand of the bureaucrats who have decided to impose that on the people of Europe. And we're starting down that path here with the accommodations, with the repression of free speech, with a lot of the things that Europe has done, and we're taking their bad example. Is there a place we can learn from that?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that, you know, learning is one thing. We are experiencing the exact same forces and movement here. We're much bigger, obviously, and the conditions are somewhat different. However, we have no border. We have massive invasions by demographic invasion coming up on the southern border in particular. This would be an effort that we are watching, kind of, my father used to use the phrase, the United States becoming the northern tip of South America. I mean, this is a sense of the Hispanization of the country. And then meanwhile, we're watching refugee resettlement and the Syrian, quote, refugee project, also coming in with population blocks, non-assimilable population blocks coming out of Islamic world and elsewhere, being imposed on communities across the country. This is an ongoing project. It's not like we can watch Europe and think, oh, we shouldn't begin to do that. No, we are deep into the same exact transition, this transition by bureaucrats, most of them unelected, and of course elected people who are pushing this, who are not on our side of the aisle defunding these projects and so on, not taking care of our border, etc. These are the exact same conditions we can look at in Europe in more of a microcosm because of the size of the individual nations involved. But we are being replaced also, and our culture is being absolutely taken over in similar ways. The differences are differences of continent, differences of size, differences of you know, our own special conditions. But the same people, the same ideas, the same actions are transforming us as Europe is being transformed.
Thanks a lot, Diana. That's bracing news. Up next, we will be talking with Samuel Bendit on defense and policy issues. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts. Now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and I'm joined by Samuel Bendit, a defense and foreign policy analyst here in the D.C. area. Sam, I wanted to ask you about the bear, Russia. Our good friend Vlad the Impaler Putin seems to be back in the old game of Russia as a dominant power, rebuilding an empire, trying to basically reassert themselves on the stage. And I wanted to get your opinion about how much of that might be internal politics and how much is an actual move by them to be a global player and to be a superpower, I think, is the goal for Putin from my perspective. What do you think?
I think Russia always had this plan all along. In 1991-92, Russia assumed the mantle of Soviet Union. Now, to them, it meant they assumed responsibilities that Soviet Union had on the global stage, which included all manner of involvement in various economic, political, and other developments. The United States, for a long time, assumed that Russia, without Soviet Union, would remain a regional power. But Russians never thought of themselves as just another regional power confined to the borders of the Russian Federation. To them, they always thought of themselves as going forward and doing the same things that Soviet Union used to do, perhaps on a different level and with different partners. So it's not that they are returning to the global stage. They've been at the global stage, maybe not as actively as the United States and some of its other political international partners, but they've always been there. And so for them, it's almost natural to essentially continue with the policies that forward Russian interests internationally, beyond the borders of Soviet Union and beyond the immediate borders of Eurasia, as we're now observing in Syria.
This is Jim Hansen, and we're talking with Samuel Bendit, who is a defense and foreign policy analyst. And I wanted to ask you, you wrote a piece about how Vladimir Putin talks about autonomy for some of the former Soviet republics. And I'm curious what your thoughts are about whether or not he has an interest in bringing them back into some sort of orbit with Russia, whether it's an alliance, a partnership, or whether, like the Crimea, they become part of Russia again. What do you see his views and his potential moves in that direction?
Well, I think Russia always considered former Soviet and Russian imperial space as one space, tied together economically, socio-ethnically, religiously, because so many Russians settled in the territories which have now become independent states. So when Putin talks about the breakup of Soviet Union as one of the big tragedies of the 20th century, he's referring to the fact that what appears to him as a natural entity was forcefully broken up without any foresight or without any long-term plan. And certainly in the early 90s, it felt like that comment was justified because new independent states plunged into economic, social, political, and even military turmoil. And so he sees these small states, especially those in the Caucasus, for example, Armenia, states like Moldova, which is separated from Soviet Union, from Russia by Ukraine and Romania, states like Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan, which have always struggled to maintain sort of independent economic and other policies and were dependent on Soviet Russia for all manner of resources. He considers their closer ties to future Russian state as normal and natural. Now, obviously, many of these smaller independent republics don't think so, but there's a lot of people within Russia who thought that Russian investment in building up and developing these regions economically should be justified by a greater cohesion amongst them in some kind of new political and economic entity. And certainly his push for an economic union is a step in that direction. Ukraine, Belarus, Russia, and Kazakhstan were tied together most closely in the Soviet Union through various social, economic, and other means, not the least of which were transportation corridors. When those ties were severed, everyone suffered. a lot of those newly independent states suffered most of all. Now, a lot of them have since recovered. A lot of them have rebuilt their infrastructure. A lot of them have reoriented themselves towards new economic partners, perhaps Europe, perhaps China, maybe even the Middle East. But to Russia, this enormous investment that took place centuries through transfer of talent, capital, through military campaigns cannot be for naught. And therefore, Putin sees Russia as the epicenter of the new entity that would essentially be a unique Eurasian state. And that's exactly what the Eurasian Union is. In his eyes, in the eyes of his government, it is not just an economic union, but some kind of a new civilizational union to compete with Asia and China, with West and the United States, and other entities around the world.
That seems to be the goal, and I think he's made that clear. Obviously, they took Crimea back. They are, you know, in the process of working on Ukraine in a number of ways, whether it's an attempt to take them over, whether it's an attempt to leverage them, as you said, back into some sort of larger economic slash political slash cultural partnership. And I don't know that there's any of us, you know, any of the forces of the West that have shown any interest in slowing that down to the extent that Putin's willing to do it. And that's really the scary part.
We've certainly done that on a very small scale, for example, with Baltics. It was easier to do so with the Baltic states of Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, because on a pure regional and political and even civilizational levels, those states were never really part of the Russian sphere. They were always part of Europe, whether under Swedish influence, under German influence, and their separation from Soviet heritage was the fastest. Again, not without problems, not without economic issues, and not without rising socio-ethnic tensions, but their separation was the easiest, but on a much smaller scale. Apart from that, the United States would have had to invest heavily in essentially kind of a new nation-building set of programs dealing with those new independent states politically, trying to open them up. Not just economically, but also socially, making sure that democratic principles would take root over the past two decades so that people would start believing that a new alternative democratic Western system would work. Now, again, there were programs like that managed by State Department, managed by U.S. Agency for International Development, managed by their European counterparts, but this is a long-term process. It takes a lot of money, it takes a lot of influence, and it doesn't happen overnight. I think one of the biggest issues and misconceptions in the early 90s in the West, and especially in Washington, D.C., was that Russian people, former Soviet people, would immediately take up a new alternative political system of democracy as something that would work better for them. Now, generational changes and personal preferences take a long time to develop. For some people, this change happened very quickly. For many others, it's still taking place. So thinking that former Soviet states would suddenly become open and democratic virtually in the span of a decade was probably one of the biggest misconceptions. It wasn't a wrong assumption, but perhaps the timing was wrong. Maybe it won't take place in a decade. Maybe it should take place over a biblical period of about two generations.
Well, I tell you what, it would be a shame for those no longer under the Russian boot to be drawn back into that because we don't do what we can to foster that or at least to slow down Putin's ambitions. Sam Bendit, we are greatly appreciative of your informative analysis of the Russian ambitions. Up next, we'll be talking with Joseph Heumeier, Executive Director at the Center for a Free Society. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260. The Answer.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Today, Barack Obama is going to dignify a mosque in Baltimore, Maryland with a presidential visit. We've recently learned that he is doing so against the advice of senior law enforcement officials. According to a report by WND, they're concerned that the mosque in question, the Islamic Society of Baltimore, has a long history of ties to terrorism. Why on earth would the President of the United States endorse such Islamic supremacists? Unfortunately, he has been associating with their ilk from the get-go of his presidency. Worse yet, some have served in his administration as policymakers or advisors. Mr. Obama's outreach to the wrong sorts of Muslims has helped legitimate their bogus claims to be community leaders. It's also emboldening them in their ambition to replace our Constitution with their totalitarian Sharia code and our government with a caliphate. This is Frank Gaffney.
This is Fred Fleischer with the Center for Security Policy. The newest twist in the Hillary Clinton email scandal was the discovery of top-secret SAP material in unclassified emails on her private email server. SAP stands for Special Access Program. This was extremely sensitive information above the top-secret level, the compromise of which could cause loss of life and severe damage to U.S. national security. This was not the first report of classified information on Clinton's server. So what are the chances that hostile intelligence services hacked Clinton's email server? Former Secretary of Defense Robert Gates thinks the odds are pretty high that countries like Iran, China, and Russia did hack this server. So how did this happen? The reason is that Hillary Clinton didn't think laws on official email and protecting classified information applied to her. If elected president this fall, Clinton will bring the same kind of dangerous arrogance to the White House. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Jim Hansen, and this segment we'll be talking with Joseph Heumeier, Executive Director at the Center for a Secure Free Society. And Joseph, I wanted to focus a little bit closer to home, but on some things that I think have international implications, but a little more locally focused. Our good friends 90 miles from Key West in Cuba, the Castro brothers, are, I guess, on their last legs. They seem to have been on their last legs forever. It would be nice if they would both just keel over and die. But in the last, you know, gasps of that regime, there seems to be a lot of outreach. Obviously, Obama normalized relations with them, and they are making a lot of friends around the world and trying to increase trade. The French seem to be doing some new trade relation discussions with them. But if you look at that regime and overall the chances for anything other than more badness coming out of a transition, what do you see?
Well, first of all, Jim, thanks for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be on. It's a good point. I think what we're talking about here is signaling. And the Obama rapprochement with the Castros in Cuba, which is a 50-year-old communist dictatorship on the island, as you said, you know, just miles off the coast of Florida, it really sent a signal internationally that it's okay to do business with Cuba. Not that other countries haven't done business with Cuba in the past, because granted, the only country that's embargoed them is the United States. So they've been doing business with Canada, Europe, for years, but open diplomatic relations and just kind of a greater sense of ability to reach out. Now, you pose a good question, which, you know, is this just normal diplomatic relationships that are trying to be built, or perhaps strengthened, or could there be more nefarious objectives? Well, the cash was because they've been living underground. When I say underground, I mean like they've been living within informal economies and many times illicit economies over the last several years because of their underperforming society. They basically bank on a lot of illicit networks. So I would pay special attention to some of the countries that they reach out to. And if they're trying to take these illicit networks and formalize them because they have more legitimacy, as you mentioned, you know, the cashers have been, you know, it's often talked about in Washington about we need a new policy with Cuba, that we can't be stuck in the Cold War. But the only person or the only entity that's stuck in the Cold War is Cuba. I mean, it literally is the same people from the Cold War that are governing that country. And so, you know, we're not going to see many different intentions and motivations behind the Cuban government because it's the same people have the same mindset that are running the country.
Well, I would like to think that, I don't know, is there any chance for a popular re-revolution, de-revolution? You know, I mean, the people have been oppressed for so long. Anytime any sort of, you know, democratic or different type of cultural or political movement comes into play, they crush it in the old school Cold War way. So is there any chance that can change? I mean, with the death of the two leaders, or is somebody else just going to step in?
I mean, I always like to stay optimistic, and it's always hard to predict these kind of things and predict the future. But I mean, I think oftentimes in Washington, we try to overestimate our ability to control the outcome of certain countries and certain regions and their internal affairs. And perhaps we think that, you know, I think I even heard the administration say this in one of the press releases, that they think that this kind of relationship with Cuba may open the door for civil society and other elements to empower themselves and perhaps spark some kind of democratic revolution. Unfortunately, we haven't seen any evidence that about a year out from the new diplomatic rekindling of relationships. And I think we underestimate the ability that the Cuban government has to control its populace. I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, and they've increasingly gotten better. And I'd say perhaps they're one of the best in the world, and best in the kind of quotations, in the ability to repress civil society, political opposition, human rights groups, and basically just be able to quell any dissent on the island. I mean, they teach other countries how to do this. So they're like the trainer of trainers to some degree of being able to have internal population control. And so I sometimes think that we overestimate our ability to change that with the U.S. policy. I don't think there's anything that the U.S. policy can do to change that. I think that's something that only can be changed with regime change.
We're talking with Joseph Heumeier, and I want to shift gears back to an area that everyone seems to be focused on because it's a mess, but that seems to be moving some of the interest into our hemisphere. And that's specifically Turkey and Iran. Obviously, both are deeply involved in the problems in Iraq, Syria, and in that region as a whole, but both are also deeply involved in our hemisphere. You know, obviously, the Iranians had involvement in the bombing of the Jewish Cultural Center. They have had Hezbollah ties and have done a number of other things. So we have a legitimate concern with them, but apparently the Turks now seem, under, you know, Erdogan, to be moving into the Latin America sphere as well. Tell us a little bit about what they're up to.
Well, I mean, you said it correctly in the sense that the Iranians have had the longest, most strongest presence in Latin America over time. They've been, say, give or take, it goes back to at least 30, 35 years since the dawn of the revolution in Iran, really, that they've been able to establish their foothold in south of the U.S. border. I think it's really within the last few years, say the last 5-6 years, that the rest of the Muslim world has started to pay attention to that. In the past, it was very quiet. It was, you know, there's a presence that wasn't necessarily promoted too heavily within the Middle East. However, in the last few years, Iran, especially under the tenure of the last president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, has made it his business to kind of project its image of they're not isolated internationally and they have friends in far places, particularly pointing to particular leaders in Latin America. Well, the rest of the Middle East had paid attention. Turkey under Erdogan, I think, is one of those that has started to look at Latin America and seeing what kind of opportunities exist for it in the Western Hemisphere. But also Saudi Arabia, Egypt, other countries have started to pay more attention to Latin America. And I think it has to do with fundamentally two things. One is the propagation of their version of Islam. So, Sunni is more predominant in the Middle East and it's more predominant in in Latin America as well. The most Muslim populations, as small as they may be in particular countries, or as large as they may be in places like the tri-border area in South America, are largely Sunni-dominated populations. Yet the Iranians have been the first to show up, so they've been able to take these Sunni populations and kind of move them more into their geopolitical orbit. And now I'm sure like countries like Saudi Arabia don't take that too lightly. So they kind of trying to move in and trying to, you know, push that back towards their favor. So that's the first thing, I think, is trying to determine the likelihood of the growth of these Islamic communities in Latin America. And the second is, I think, geopolitical posturing. Iran has basically been able to turn Latin America into one of its probably preferred regions and priorities in its foreign policy. And so they have a lot of influence in that region, more than we like to give it credit for. And as the Middle East plays out and the balance of power plays out in the Middle East, other countries are realizing that if you just concentrate yourself within your near abroad, you lose that international legitimacy that Iran's been able to build, and you get less powerful at home. And so I think some of the leaders are following in the footsteps.
Here's what scares the bejesus out of me. We've got a Sunni-Shia proxy war going on in Iraq and Syria. We've got a Sunni-Shia proxy war going on in Yemen. If there is jockeying for position between Iran and potentially Turkey and the Gulf Arab states for Sunni versus Shia dominance in our hemisphere, in Latin America, you know, South America, and if it filters it all our direction, that's a recipe for potential disaster. Is there a chance that could be part of the play?
Yeah, that's a good point. There's potential spots in Latin America that I think are largely ignored and we don't fully understand the level of Islamic penetration. I point to particularly South America. Venezuela, for instance, has a high level the growth of the Islamic population, not in terms of necessarily just raw numbers, but the level of influence, or ability to go within the government, to have pressure groups and lobbying groups, and kind of just change the tide of the country towards, what we're seeing in the Middle East, towards more Islamic doctrine and Sharia law. There's an effort to do that, that could be a potential, you know, midterm outcome where you see a jockeying for power in the Middle East on between Islamic powers, and that would obviously spell quite a disaster in a country like Venezuela, where there already is a lack of governance, or I'd say more like a lack of state control over certain things, because the country just is spiraling into anarchy. That could spell into some other kind of proxy war.
Joseph Heumeier, Executive Director at the Center for a Secure Free Society, thank you so much for your insights into both of those issues. Coming up next, we will talk with the Center for Security Policy's own Fred Flights. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Every day, the men and women of the United States Marine Corps demonstrate their commitment to defend the American way of life. Since 1775, we have served our nation as a force in readiness.
Get some rear security.
From combat operations to humanitarian assistance in every corner of the world. No matter where the mission takes us today, or wherever our country needs us tomorrow, we always remember the land we call home. As Marines, we take a stand for each other, for our nation, for us all. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. in an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization. The Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. And we are going to wrap up the show today with one of the all-stars of our Center for Security Policy team, Fred Flights. Fred, I wanted to jump into one of the strengths of your portfolio, and you have been doing a bang-up job watching Iran and watching them dominate the talks with us, the deal with us, the region, everything. I mean, they've been taking us to the woodshed. They have beaten Obama like a rented mule in pretty much every interaction they've had with him. And there's a couple more pieces of this just recently that have shown how bad this non-deal, this faux deal, this Obama legacy padding has been. Fill us in on the latest outrages.
I mean, we know that Iran has been going on a shopping spree in Europe, trying to spend its sanctions relief. The administration tried to play down how much sanctions relief Iran would receive. It had said that it would only be $50 billion, when experts were saying $100 to $150 billion. However, the Treasury Department yesterday said it, in fact, would be $100 billion. The State Department tried to depict this as a rounding error.
Yeah, I would love a rounding error with my bank of $50 billion. Holy cow, that would make
that's exactly
my...
exactly right.
Oh, my God.
But it goes to the heart. Nothing that this administration says about the Iran deal has been true. I mean, they've misled and exaggerated and dragged their feet as much as possible, because this deal is just terrible. They've never owned up to what it really amounts to. And that's why there's efforts in Congress right now to pass new sanctions. Now, on the 2nd of February, the House passed a bill which will try to add responsibility to how sanctions will be lifted. It was passed, unfortunately, almost entirely with, it's called the Iran Terror Finance Act, with Republican support. It's going to bar the lifting of sanctions on individuals and entities involved to run the ballistic missile terrorism program. Senator Corker is thinking of sanctions on missiles, human rights, terrorism. He also wants to extend the Iran Sanctions Act, which is going to expire at the end of this year. He wants to do that. So does Senator Cardin and Senator Kirk. Now, this is interesting, because these senators say, let's extend this bill right now so it goes past 2016. But the Obama administration is saying, no, let's wait till the end of the year, which means it'll never happen. This is an important bill which puts trade restrictions on Iran for its ballistic missile and nuclear program. And frankly, I think the administration always intended to lift it, and they're not happy that senators are talking right now of extending it. The president is certain to veto this, and I think that probably enough Democratic senators will stand behind him. But these congressmen are really doing important work by raising the people's consciousness to how terrible this deal is and how we still have to take steps in light of Iran's continuing sponsorship of terrorism and destabilizing the Middle East.
Well, Fred, let's keep digging a bit into this, because obviously with President Obama in office, he can veto pretty much anything. Is there any hope that this Congress can do anything to bind this president from continuing to give Iran everything they want, or do we have to wait for the next one?
I think that the Democrats in the Senate are determined to stop, and the Democrats in the House, to stop any efforts to roll back the Iran nuclear deal or basically do anything that would undermine the legacy of this president. But still, I think it's worth putting the president on notice and making these Democrats take votes on this terrible deal. So basically, they're going to have to face the public at the ballot box this November.
So we've got, obviously, because we're a wonderfully free country, we get a chance to vote for both houses of Congress and a president. Does it appear that the complete national security malfeasance perpetrated by the Obama administration and aided and abetted by Democrats in Congress is an issue in the presidential and congressional campaigns, or has the public forgotten about this?
It's certainly an issue in for the Republicans. I don't think there's been a serious discussion about this in the Democratic debates. But when we finally have presidential debates between the Democratic and Republican nominee, whoever the Democratic nominee is, he or she is going to have some very difficult questions to answer about this Iran deal.
And Hillary was bragging about it. Now, in the last Democrat town hall, she actually claimed that her role in teeing up the Iran deal made it possible for Obama and John Kerry to capitulate fully and to, you know, start delivering the satchels of cash and ignoring all of the Iranian outrages, and added that to her portfolio as a success as Secretary of State. You think that's another one of the weaknesses that the Republicans can hit her on?
I think so. And she's right. She did lay the foundation for this agreement. They were working on this agreement for many years before the interim nuclear agreement was signed in 2013. I mean, it would not have happened without Hillary Clinton's tenure at state.
We're talking with Fred Flights, Vice President at the Center for Security Policy. Fred, I want to move a country or so over, or potentially just another part of the same ongoing roiling conflict. There are talks underway right now with Syria and Iraq and Iran and everyone involved with the ongoing mess. And it's hard to tell. Obviously, we've never had a handle on who the good guys versus the bad guys are. But we've invited everyone, and there's some talks going on. Is this anything more than diplomatic time-wasting, you know, more formal lying, informal wear, nibbling Pettit Fours and sipping mint tea by the pool? Is there any chance this is going to turn into something good?
I don't think the American people know what's going on with this diplomatic talks. The president, Secretary Kerry, had been praising their efforts to bring about peace talks. But we have groups that don't want to talk to each other. The Syrian opposition does not want to negotiate until the bombing of Syrian civilians stops, blockades of siege cities where people are dying of starvation stops. And there's a process for Assad stepping down, President Assad stepping down. The Russians have intensified bombings as the talks began. And it looks like the Syrian government and the Russian government are using the bombing as leverage to gain their position in these talks. The talks are a fiasco. And, you know, they began on Monday. The Syrian opposition is refusing even to speak to the UN liaison. And even though certain minimum conditions, such as the stop of bombings and the ending of blockades, were supposed to be a precondition to a ceasefire, the administration of the UN is pushing forward with a ceasefire anyway. I mean, it's basically the administration wants to say it's doing something, even though the something they're doing is not going to have any effect whatsoever. It may actually make the situation worse.
And as you mentioned, the Russians and their, you know, puppet Assad, they seem to have decided that, no, he can stay. That'll be fine. And everyone needs to accept that as the status quo. And to enforce that, as you mentioned, they're willing to make things considerably worse. Is the combination of that Russian intransigence, and the Iranians are complicit in that, and the Obama's administration's desire to do something, if anything, as they've proven, it doesn't have to be helpful. Could that lead to just an enforced ceasefire where the Syrian people have to take it and, you know, bow down to their continued dictatorship?
Well, first of all, the Washington Post has a really damning editorial on February 3rd, saying that it's time for the administration to force Russia and Syria to live up to its obligations. We know that's not going to happen. But let me talk about a related issue, which I think is important. Senator Cruz has made this over and over again. What happens if Assad leaves? What happens if Assad leaves? We know that ISIS and the Al-Nusra Front, the Al-Qaeda franchise in the country, are making significant gains in the country. The administration has no idea what would happen if Assad stepped down. And we know a lot of these opposition groups are Islamists and want to set up an Islamic state. I'm really concerned about if this dog actually caught this car, what will happen?
Fred Flights, Vice President at the Center for Security Policy, thank you so much for your insight. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. Frank Gaffney will be back to continue the war of ideas and the fight for the free world. This is Jim Hansen, and we're out.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.